Over the course of the week, we want to uncover, I suppose, some essential lessons and stories from the life of some remarkable people that lived in the time of the Judges. And the time period of the Judges is probably one of the most intriguing sections of the Bible and in the history of the nation of Israel. It's a time that was characterized by just countless battles and immense bloodshed and extreme violence. You know, it was a time we find the nation, though, that they frequently lost sight of the God whom they served and turned aside from practicing true worship under Joshua's guidance and become steeped in idolatry and in corruption and rapid moral decay. And what we find, brothers and sisters, is we find that this is a state that they inherited because of a lack of faithful leadership from their parents' generation. It's a state, though, that they accepted as their parents failed to utterly remove the nations from before them as they received their inheritance upon entering the promised land. And the book of the Judges is a documented narrative, isn't it, brothers and sisters, of a nation in whose history depicted faithlessness, idolatry, and corruption. And yet scattered through this dark period of Israel's times, the scripture highlights for us some remarkable characters who demonstrate incredible faith, bravery, and spiritual perception, whom God used and God raised to inspire and to encourage and to revitalize a remnant of his people to continue to keep the promise and his purpose alive throughout time. You know, it's those inspirational examples that we want to explore with Deborah and Barak and Jael, and we wish to gain some incredible insights from powerful lessons in leadership for us today, and to gain encouragement from what they were able to achieve as we endeavour to cast aside our enemies and the environment that we live in to try and seize our inheritance and prepare for the kingdom. And so, over the course of our six studies together, we're going to have a look at six studies. Right, so Deborah, we're going to have a look at tonight, the inspirational prophetess. But before we look at Deborah, we want to have a look at the background to her remarkable, what makes her so remarkable. We want to have a look at the background to her as a person. And then in our second study tonight, we're going to have a look at Barak. What was his challenge? What was the problem? How Deborah motivates him to get him to take a role that he was hesitantly not fulfilling, and to uncover how she worked with him so that we can learn lessons around helping each other as well in our walk. Then we're going to have a look in our exhort tomorrow at the lovely story of Jael, and we're going to call that the displaced wife, and we'll see why as we get into the story. And then we want to have a look in our fourth study during the middle of the week on the tribes and Deborah's song, right? What Deborah sings about, what makes her and Barak sing their hearts out about this, about what they did and what they didn't do, and what they were so encouraged and what they were so disgusted by when they looked at the nation at the time. And then on our Thursday night, I think it is, we want to have a look at the interesting insight that Deborah sings about at the end of Judges chapter 5 about Sisera's mum, Sisera's mother. What on earth was Deborah talking about at the end of Judges chapter 5 about a woman who's dwelling in a castle with her maidens, and what was actually going on in the story? And what we find, brothers and sisters, in that study is that actually the destruction of Sisera was only but a prelude to the main event. That actually Sisera's destruction was actually just a catalyst for the nation to respond and to seize their inheritance that they had failed to take. And that's what Deborah and Barak are going to sing about. And Sisera's mum, well, she was the queen of the empire, and of course the type is absolutely obvious with Armageddon and the subjugation of Europe, with this woman who dominated a castle. And then what we want to do in our final study together with the exhort on the following Sunday is to have a look at this expression, leading captivity captive. What does Paul see in Deborah's song and in David's commentary that gets pulled from Moses that was so remarkable about what Christ accomplished in how he led and what that demands of each and every one of us in terms of our response and our leadership and our ecclesias? So, That's the course of the next six studies. Hopefully stay with us as we endeavour to go through this remarkable story. Okay, so Deborah and the story in the context of her times. This study, we want to spend some time to show that the issue of the nation at this point in time was that of failed leadership. There weren't people standing up to take the responsibility amongst the nation to help them understand God's purpose and God's ways. Why was that? What happened? How did they get to this point? Yet it's remarkable, isn't it, that the nation of Israel come out of Egypt, they seize their inheritance, God works amongst them, and then only a very short period of time later, they've totally lost the plot. How and why did that occur? Well, this afternoon we want to actually have a look at how that occurred. And so we find as Israel leaves the wilderness and crosses over the River Jordan, Joshua assists the nation to take control. And after a series of military campaigns, the nation who once occupied the land of Canaan were subdued, and the 12 tribes received their allotted inheritance in the land. And the Levites, well, they received their cities of refuge, and the tabernacle was established in Shiloh. And we know that that's all the story, because in Joshua 18, don't turn this up, in verse 1, it says that the land was subdued before them. But come with me to Joshua chapter 21. I want to show you that there's some interesting expressions that we can see start to unfold as we get into the story of this story of Judges. So Joshua 21, the land is subdued before them. And Joshua says in Joshua 21 in verse 43, he says, right, so thus everyone in their suburbs were given to the Levites, this their inheritance. And it says in the summary of Joshua 21, and of course if you went through the back of Joshua 21, it's the allocation of the cities of refuge and the inheritances of Levi. But at the end of that chapter, it says in verse 43, Joshua 21, and Yahweh gave unto Israel all the land which he sware to give unto their fathers, and they possessed it and dwelt therein. So they received all of it. It was the land, notice, that he sware unto, here's your colouring in pencil, their fathers. Right? And Yahweh gave them rest all about, according to all that he sware, unto their fathers. And there stood not a man of all their enemies before them. Yahweh delivered them all their enemies into their hand. There failed not aught any good thing which Yahweh had spoken unto the house of Israel. All came to pass. Can you get the emphasis of Joshua 21? That God promised that he would give unto their fathers everything that he said. And exactly what he promised he gave. And he gave it unto their fathers. All came to pass that Yahweh had spoken unto the house of Israel. All of it came to pass. And so, brothers and sisters and young people, under Joshua's leadership and under their guidance, the tribes took their inheritance. And whilst the work was started, there remained yet work to be completed. Whilst the land had been subdued before them, the nations amongst them had not yet fully been eradicated. They had to yet finish what Joshua had begun. And Joshua knew that, and he knew the importance of that, and he calls the nation together in Joshua chapter 23. Come with me to Joshua chapter 23. So they had begun, they had subdued the land, all the enemies had been given into their hand, everything God had promised them had happened, and Joshua knew that there was a lesson still that they had to finish. And so he calls the nation together at the end of his life to warn them and to exhort them and to encourage them to complete the task to remain faithful to their obliteration of their enemies. And so in Joshua 23 and verse 1 it says, and it came to pass a long time after Yahweh had given rest unto Israel from all their enemies round about, that Joshua waxed old and was stricken in age. Joshua can no longer lead in front of them. And Joshua calls the nation of Israel together and says to them, calls for the elders, notice, and for the heads and for their judges, and for their officers. Why does he do that, brothers and sisters and young people? Because he's wanting to inspire the leaders amongst the nation to continue the work that he now can't do. He calls for the leadership amongst the nation, and he says to them, I'm old, I'm stricken in age, and ye have seen all that Yahweh your God hath done unto you, all these nations because of you. Yahweh your God is he that hath fought for you. You already know. Notice the past tense. He's already fought for you. You know that. So he says, behold, I have divided, verse 4, unto you by lot these nations that remain to be an inheritance for all your tribes from Jordan with all the nations that I have cut off even unto the great sea westward. And Yahweh your God, he shall, here's the future, he shall expel them from before you and drive them from out of your sight, and ye shall possess their land as Yahweh your God hath promised you. But he says, it requires something really special. Be ye therefore, verse 6, very courageous to keep and to do all that is written in the book of the law of Moses, that ye turn not aside from the left to the right, that ye come not among these nations, these that remain among you, neither make mention of the name of their gods, nor cause them to swear by you, neither serve nor bow yourselves unto them, but cleave unto Yahweh your God as ye have done this day. For Yahweh hath driven out from among you great nations and strong. But as for you, no man shall be able to stand before you this day. One man of you shall chase 1,000. For Yahweh your God, he it is that fighteth for you as he hath promised you. Can you see the links from chapter 21 to chapter 23? Take, he says, here's the exhortation. Take good heed, therefore, unto yourselves, that ye love Yahweh your God. Else, if ye do in any wise go back and cleave unto the remnant of these nations, even those that remain among you, and make marriages with them, and go in unto them, and they to you, know, he says for a surety, that Yahweh your God will no more drive out any of these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps unto you, and scourges in your side, and thorns in your eyes, and until ye perish from off the good land which Yahweh hath given for you. And so Joshua's message was pretty simple. His exhortation was it: remove them or be removed yourself. It's simple. You've got to finish the job we've started, else you will be removed. Watch out for these nations, and just in your mind, just remember that. Verse 13, know for a certainty that Yahweh your God shall no more drive out any of these nations from before you, but they shall be snares and traps. Notice that. We'll see that's exactly what happens in Psalm 106. And so they had to be very courageous. And he warns them about the nations that remained amongst them. They had to finish the job. And if you had the colouring in pencil, colour it in. Those that may remain among you, all right? Those that remain among you. Happens twice, verse 7 and verse 12. There was a remnant that still needed to be eradicated from among them. And so what happens? The leadership passes away. Those that are strong die. And the next generation, brothers and sisters, have to stand up. And so we come now to Judges chapter 1. And so what happens now is Joshua dies. Verse 1 of Judges chapter 1, it says, now after the death of Joshua, it came to pass that the children of Israel asked Yahweh, saying, who shall go up for us against the Canaanites first to fight? Let's take Joshua's expression and Joshua's words, and let's finish the job. And so they begin. And what happens, brothers and sisters, and we won't have time to spend in Judges chapter 1, but in the screen you'll see that they begin to eradicate the nations that were amongst them with gusto. So Judah takes Simeon with him after seeking Yahweh's blessing, and they start out with incredible determination. And so in verses 4 to 7, the Canaanites with Judah are destroyed and conquered in Jerusalem. The Canaanites then in verses 8 to 15 are overcome and destroyed in Hebron. The Canaanites are wiped out and destroyed in Hormah in verse 17. The Canaanites are annihilated and destroyed in Philistia and Gaza and Ashkelon and Ekron. They're all gone. Judah shot off to a flying start. Why? We'll come and have a look across the page. Judges chapter 1 and verse 9. Why was it that they could do this with so much ease? Verse 19 says that Yahweh was with Judah and he drove out the inhabitants of the mountain. He started off with a flying start because Yahweh was with him. He sought Yahweh's blessing and they went for it. But then the mission came to a grinding halt. The verse says in verse 19, but could not drive out the inhabitants of the valley because they had chariots of iron. You know, they couldn't drive them out. They had chariots of iron. You see, Judah was absolutely enthusiastic about their work and their inheritance. They commenced their battles with eager zeal and passion, supported by their brethren from Simeon. However, as soon as the work started to encounter some obstacles and challenge, they came face to face with chariots of iron. And all of a sudden, brothers and sisters, their faith and their trust in God was tested and it melted. I think sometimes we can be very easy to judge Judah in this time. You know, we can think, oh, come on, why couldn't they carry it off? You know, it's not hard to think how hard that might have been, brothers and sisters. They were fighting tanks with toothpicks. They had nothing in their hand. They were bringing a knife to a gunfight here. The chariots, they had nothing. But they had Yahweh. And Joshua, and you could be easily forgiven for sort of, you know, forgiving Judah for having some challenges. But God was with them. And without God, they would have been completely ill-equipped to battle the Canaanites. But Joshua had given them a warning. Brothers and sisters, a warning that they would face this challenge. They would come face to face, faced with chariots of iron. Have a look. Just hold your hand here in Judges 1 and turn back to Joshua chapter 17. He had warned them of this. Joshua 17, verse 17. So this was Judah. This was the children of Joseph. He told them that they'd face these things. They said, well, hey, look, the children of Joseph said, verse 13, hey, mate, we haven't got a big enough portion. You know, why have you given me just one lot and one portion to inherit, seeing I'm such a great people, verse 14. And Joshua said, well, if you're a great people, you get up into the wood and cut it down yourselves. Knock them out. The children said, well, the hill's not enough for us. All the Canaanites dwell in the land of the valley. They've got chariots of iron, verse 16. Right, both they of whom are Beth Shan and their towns of the Valley of Jezreel. They've got chariots. The Valley of Jezreel, brothers and sisters, we're going to come across the chariots of iron in the Valley of Jezreel all again in the story of Deborah and Barak. And Joseph says, oh, that's going to be too hard for me. Oh, mate, I'm taking this hill country. Yeah, I could cut down some forest. Sure I can, but I can't take that area. And Joshua turns around in verse 17. And says to the house of Joseph, even to Ephraim and Manasseh, says, thou art a great people. You hast great power. Thou shalt not just have one lot only, but the mountain shall be thine, for it is the wood, and thou shalt cut it down, and the outgoings of it shall be for thine. For thou shalt drive out the Canaanites, though they have iron chariots, and though they be strong. You will do it, says Joshua. Get on with it. And so Judah encounters chariots of iron and their faith melts before. He says, listen, you're going to face that issue and you need to be strong enough to have courage that God is strong enough to help you. But you know, here's the sad, sad thing about Judges chapter 1. Because Judges 1 is now going to depict for us what happens when one person or one tribe fails to finish the job. You see, it was Judah's faithless leadership because of chariots of iron that now set up a disastrous precedent for the other nations who failed to completely eradicate their challenges in their inheritances. Judah was first, but tribe after tribe after tribe now failed to drive out the inhabitants from the land. Judah first, verse 19. They could not utterly drive out the inhabitants of the valley. But then Benjamin could neither, verse 21. Neither did Benjamin drive out the Jebusites. Neither could Manasseh, verse 28. Neither did he utterly drive them out. Verse 29, Ephraim. Neither did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites. Verse 30, neither did Zebulun drive out the inhabitants. Verse 31, and Asher, neither did Asher drive out the inhabitants. And they just colored the pencil and right across, they could not utterly drive them out, did not utterly drive them out, did not do it. One after the other, Judah, Benjamin, Manasseh, Ephraim, Zebulun, Asher. One tribe cascades now amongst the nation. What, like mold, brothers and sisters, that fear and cancer now permeates the remaining tribes. In verse 33 it says, and Naphtali, neither did Naphtali drive out the inhabitants. Naphtali, that's Barak's tribe. And so like mold and cancer, the faithlessness of one tribe began to spread and infected the remaining tribes until ultimately Israel compromised their divinely appointed position and purpose. They lost their faith, lost their inheritance. So much so, brothers and sisters, that Psalm 106, verse 34 to 43 says, we won't read all of it, but here's a section. They did not utterly destroy the nations concerning whom Yahweh had commanded them, but were mingled among the heathen and learned their works. They served their idols, which were, as Joshua 23, verse 13 said, would be a snare unto them. Thus were they defiled with their own works and went a-whoring with their own inventions. Therefore it says, the wrath of God kindled against his people, insomuch that he abhorred his own inheritance. He gave them into the hand of the heathen, and them that hated them ruled over them. Their enemies also oppressed them, and they were brought in under subjection, under their hand. And Psalm 106 describes for us the problem of the time of the judges, because they fell amongst the nation and intermingled. He gave, it says, into the hand of the heathen, and to them that hated them, that they ruled over them. Their enemies also oppressed them, and they were brought in subjection under their hand. Faithless leadership, brothers and sisters and young people, in the tribes, and a lack of trust in Yahweh's protective hand cost Israel their inheritance. But the question we have to ask is why? Why did their faith fail? What caused the tribe's faith in God to waver so much? Well, Judges 2 tells us exactly what happened. Come with me to Judges chapter 2 and verse 6. Here's the summary of why their faith failed. So Joshua 2 verse 6 says, and when Joshua had let the people go, the children of Israel went every man unto his inheritance to possess the land. And the people served Yahweh all the days of Joshua, and all the days of the leadership, the elders that outlived Joshua, who had seen all the great works of Yahweh that he did for Israel. So they served them while they were there. But then Joshua the son of Nun and the servant of Yahweh died, being 110 years old. And they buried him in the border of his inheritance in Timnath-Heres in the mount of Ephraim on the north side of the hill Gaash. And also, verse 10 says, that generation were gathered unto their fathers. So everyone that surrounded Joshua that had seen them, and all the elders and the leaders that were there at that time, that had seen the great works that Yahweh did, passed off. And now, says verse 10, there arose another generation after them, which knew not Yahweh, nor yet the works that he had done for Israel. The children of Israel did evil in the sight of Yahweh. They served Balaam. They forsook Yahweh Elohim of, here's the expression, their fathers, which brought them up out of the land of Egypt, and followed the other gods, the gods of the people that were round about them, and bowed themselves unto them and provoked Yahweh to anger. And they forsook Yahweh and served Baal and Ashtaroth. And the anger of Yahweh was hot against Israel. He delivered them into the hand of the spoilers that spoiled them, and he sold them into the hands of their enemies round about them, so that they could not any longer stand before their enemies. Brothers and sisters and young people, what was the problem? What caused their faith to fail? The answer, says the record in Judges chapter 2, was that the parents failed to transfer and to inspire the next generation and failed to pass on the mantle of leadership and responsibility to their children who hadn't witnessed the power of God in conquering the land. They failed to demonstrate in that next generation the same fervency and zeal that they themselves had. And so what happened, brothers and sisters, was that they forsook Yahweh Elohim of their fathers and served Baal and Ashtaroth. You see, the problem is that the parents failed to transfer the truth. But just as devastating, the children didn't stand up and grab it with both hands to personalize the truth for themselves. Oh, brothers and sisters and young people, here's an enormous lesson for all of us when it comes to leadership and the truth. See, there's a lesson first and foremost to parents, to leaders, to elders, those that have position of responsibility. You see, many of those have grown up. They've been in the truth for quite some time. They've experienced life. They've experienced the trials. You've seen the hand of God working in your life. Brothers and sisters, it's imperative now that we invest in the future with the next generation, because they have to play a leadership role when we're gone. We must play a leadership role in ensuring our lifelong passion and zeal in the truth that we've built up over so much time, that we've appreciated God's hand working with us in our challenges and our trials, we've got to hand that in all responsibility to the next generation. We've got to allow them room to grow, to develop in the truth, realizing that they are just starting out on the same journey that we've already embarked on many years before. And we've got to let them grow, make mistakes, and develop. It's a process, brothers and sisters. It's a journey that takes time and patience and diligence and trust, that as much as God has worked in our lives, he's going to work in theirs. And we've got to cherish that next generation. We've got to encourage that next generation to grow the same zeal, the same passion, and the same energy in service in the truth, if they're ever, ever going to have the ability to hold on to that and pass that to the next generation. I think sometimes it's very easy to be upset, build resentment, be impatient, become bitter that people haven't got the same tenacity or the same fervor that we had at their age. We've got to grow that. It's our responsibility. We've got to guide it gently. We've got to encourage it fervently. And above all else, make room for them to grow into the role of leadership so that they too can personalize the truth in the same way as we did. You see, brothers and sisters, this role isn't optional. It's imperative. It's our responsibility. It's our duty in the truth to ensure the truth remains alive and to trust that God will protect it and them to grow and to develop. It's our responsibility to pass the mantle of that responsibility to the next generation. And the truth depends on it, brothers and sisters. Because if we don't do it, it's pretty obvious what happens. So enough about the responsibility of parents and elders amongst the ecclesia. What's the responsibility for young people and for those that are growing up in the truth? Well, so I'll put myself in this bracket as well. You know, it's our responsibility as younger people in the ecclesia as we try to grow to look to the wisdom and the experience of those that have gone before us, to understand what they've achieved and why they've achieved it and how God's worked in their life, to realize that they've worn the heat and burden of the day and have learned so many life lessons that God has taught them that we might learn from them. Many have walked most of their life in the truth, and they bear the scars and the experience of trials both won and lost. But those that have worked with others through the issues of life have built up a deep appreciation of the love and power and patience and providence of God in their own lives. It's our responsibility and our duty as those growing up in the truth to respect, therefore, the thoughts and experiences of those that have gone before. But more importantly, or just as important, it is our responsibility to step up, to not shirk that responsibility, to take on the role and responsibility of trying to help and to grow and to serve, because they won't be there forever, will they, brothers and sisters? As we know. And it won't be long, and it'll be our turn to transfer that truth to our children as we grow, so that they carry on the truth if Christ remains away. Therefore, as young people, it is our responsibility to personalize the truth early, but in doing so, listen and to seek advice from those who have witnessed the power and the mercy of God in their own lives, and to take on the mantle of responsibility and to step up and serve wherever we can. And thus, brothers and sisters, by leaning in together and by God's grace, the truth will pass from generation to generation because God will bring about his purpose. See, there's great lessons, isn't it, brothers and sisters? If we're going to maintain our faith together, we have to learn to work together. But unfortunately, brothers and sisters, this didn't happen in this generation. We don't have time to look at it tonight, but if you go to the appendices of the Judges, what we see in the appendices is exactly the problem of what happens if it's not passed properly from generation to generation. Don't have time to look at it, but you know, chapters 17 to 18 of the appendices of the Judges, that fits in right at this section in Judges chapter 2, demonstrates for us, firstly, the idolatry that occurred in the tribe of Dan when one man stole from his mother and mummy says, oh, you're a good boy for returning part of it, and then builds an idol out of it. So it's disgraceful. And the idolatry in the tribe of Dan was created from the grandson of Moses. And you know what that ended up doing, brothers and sisters, was corrupting all the doctrine of the truth. And then in chapter 19 to 21, we see the story of the Levite who has a concubine who's abused by the men of Benjamin and cut up in pieces and sent around the entire 12 tribes. And the story of this in chapters 19 to 21 is the immorality in the tribe of Benjamin was caused because of the grandson of Aaron. And this demonstrates a problem with the corruption of practice. And these two stories encapsulate the challenge of the time of failed leadership and transferring the truth from generation to generation and how quickly that can happen. The appendices, we know, begin and end with a catchphrase that summarised the time of the nation of Israel. Judges 17, verse 6, And Judges 21, verse 25, the encapsulation of that, those appendices says that in those days, there was no king in Israel, but every man did that which was right in his own eyes. Do you know, sometimes we can mistake the thinking of this expression, meaning that they just did whatever they wanted. But I don't think that that's quite true. I think it's slightly worse than that. You see, I don't think necessarily it means that they did whatever they wanted. You know, the word for right, when it says every man did that which was right in his own eyes, is the word used in Deuteronomy chapter 12 and verse 8. You see, Deuteronomy 12 and verse 8 says, don't bother turning it up, I'll do it for you. Deuteronomy 12 verse 8 says, listen, Moses says, listen, I don't want you to do after the things which ye do here this day, every man doing what was right in his own eyes, for ye are not yet come into the rest of the land of your inheritance. But when you go over, I want you to do all these things in the place that God chooses. The word for right is the word for straight. It's the word for judgment, righteousness. And what they were doing was they were trying to work out the truth, but not using the law as their guide. Joshua had said that. Don't you turn from the right hand to the left. You make sure you do exactly what Moses said. We saw that in Joshua 21. When he said, listen, you need to keep straight and true. Don't do what's right in your own eyes. Don't try and work out what you think's right. And we know that when we look at the story of the Levite, he says, I think the man says, oh, yes, that's right. We need a priest. All right, you're of Levite. Great. Bang. He was trying to do the truth. But not all Levites were priests. Only the sons of Aaron were priests. So he was trying to do sort of what he thought was right, but wasn't. Complete abandonment, it distorted the truth and corrupted its practice. You see, they were doing what was right but failed to use the law as their guide, and so they apostatized from the truth. And it's interesting, brothers and sisters, who were they supposed to turn to understand what was right? Who were they to turn to? Well, Deuteronomy 16 says that he would appoint for them judges. So every man shall give as he is able. Judges 16 verse 18 says that he will put judges and officers they were supposed to make in all thy gates, which Yahweh thy God hath given thee throughout thy tribes. And they shall judge the people with just judgment. They were going to help them understand the law. The Levites weren't able to be in every city. And so God appointed judges for them. Or actually not God. Moses says, I want you to appoint judges in every city. Make sure it's done. There was no king to lead them. They had to appoint judges in every city throughout all thy gates to give just judgment. Thou shalt not wrest judgment. Thou shalt not be respect of persons, neither take a gift or be, you know, dodgy. Thou shalt altogether be just. Thou shalt follow, and that thou mayest live and inherit the land which Yahweh thy God giveth thee. That's Deuteronomy 16, verses 17 to 20. And so with no king to lead them, they were supposed to turn to the judges. But brothers and sisters, when we get to the time of Deborah and Barak, we get to the time of Ehud, where were the judges? They were supposed to be in every city, but they weren't there. They weren't there. So with no king to lead them and the failure of the judges to speak the law, well, it was natural that the dilution of the truth began. Until here they stood once more, no leader, no knowledge, no hope, doing that which they thought was right in their own eyes and rapidly losing everything. So in Joshua chapter 2 it says that God raised them up judges. Verse 16, nevertheless, Yahweh raised up judges which delivered them out of the hand of those that spoiled them. Joshua 2 verse 16. And yet they would not hearken unto the judge, but they went a-whoring after their own gods and bowed themselves unto them, and they were quickly turned out of the way. You see, God raised up judges. Judges were supposed to judge the people in all spiritual matters. And God raised up judges both to respond to the idolatry and to lead the people in their responsibility to overcome their enemies. And so the first judge that God raises is Ehud. We have no time to look at the story. Fascinating story with a man who was just amazing with his left hand, straight with a dagger, under the fat guts of, of Eglon and disappears, and he dies, and the nation has this incredible piece of time from Ehud's leadership, who snuck in and absolutely wiped out the problem for them and showed them what it meant to lead and to how to overcome. And so they had 80 years of peace under his reign. And one after the other, God raised up judge after judge after judge. But as with leaders, if people don't follow, things fall back. And so we pick up the story now, brothers and sisters, in Judges chapter 4. So here we are, without leadership amongst the nation, a vacuum created because Ehud's now dead. And once more, without that solid leadership, a void opens up once more. And thus, once again, the children of Israel fall into apostasy because he is gone. And we pick up the story now in Judges chapter 4 and verse 1. Hopefully you can see how this all builds to the story of how amazing it is for this particular prophet, Tess, to turn up amongst the nation. And so it says, Judges 4 and verse 1, that the children of Israel did again evil in the sight of Yahweh when Ehud was dead. And Yahweh sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan. You see, Ehud had provided a secure environment through God's assistance, both military and spiritual leadership. The people ought to have leveraged this time. 80 years he gave them to consolidate their inheritance, but they failed to capitalize on the opportunity. And failing to realize that the 80 years that they received was actually a gift of God, they apostatized and used it to their own end. They missed it through complacency and mistaken self-assurance. They thought God was with them, but not because they moved into apostasy. And so once again, they do evil in the sight of Yahweh. You know, Judges chapter 5, Deborah sings in her song, they choose new gods. Judges 5 verse 8, they chose new gods. And what happened, brothers and sisters? There was war in the gates. There was war in the gates. Where was the judge supposed to be, brothers and sisters? The judge was supposed to be sitting in the gate, providing just judgment. But because they had forsaken the judge, because they had forsaken God, because they had apostatized, instead of a judge giving righteous laws, they now had war. And so it says, God sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan. There's irony in that, brothers and sisters. Human nature doesn't change, and neither does God's punishment. He traded them to a group of traders. There's irony in it, brothers and sisters. He trades them, he sells them to a group of traders. The Canaanites. The Canaanites means the lowland. They come from the root word meaning to bend the knee, right? Or to humiliate. Do you know who they were? They were a trading nation of merchants who would sell their soul to get a deal. And their leader, Jabin, his name means whom God observes. Whom God observes. Really? Of course, because God put him there. His name comes from the root word meaning understanding or intelligence. That's Jabin, whom God observes from the root word of understanding and intelligence. You see, this one was the CEO of a merchant trading nation who was the entire representation of the wisdom of the world in all its conceit and all its glory. He's the CEO, the wisdom of the world, intelligence, and God put him in this place. And you know, he gripped that nation of Israel and grabbed them and poured them under, sold them into his hand and crushed them. And he's reigning in Hazor, just means a castle. And he's got this dominant castle over the entire region with iron tentacles. And he's crushing them. And he rules over the vast area from the land of the north of Galilee right down through the Jezreel Valley. And how did he dominate these people? Well, it says that he had Sisera and 900 chariots of iron. You know, it's very easy, brothers and sisters, to read through this story and to read that there was a hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. But brothers and sisters, if we had done our readings, we would know that this had already happened not long ago. Have a look in your margin against H, or in the Y margin Bible, Joshua chapter 11. Yahweh sells them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan. Hang on a minute. Joshua 11 had already told us about a king by the name of Jabin who had lived in a castle called Hazor once before. Come back for me to Joshua chapter 11. You see, this is a repeat. Why is it a repeat? Joshua 11 says, in verse 1, came to pass when Jabin, king of Hazor, had heard these things, he sent Jobab, king of Madron, and the king of Shimeon, and the king of Ashphar, to the kings that were on the mountains, and to go up against them. And they were, verse 4 says, that they were all their host, were much people, even as the sand which is upon the seashore in multitude, with horses and chariots many. We've seen this man before. Jabin, who's reigning in Hazor, with all these chariots and horses. And Joshua, in a previous military campaign, had taken Jabin the First out in the first battles and crusades in the land. You see, the kings of Canaan joined forces. There's sand of the seashore for multitude, and they had horses and chariots. And Joshua wipes them out in verse 8. Look what it says. And so, verse 7, so Joshua came and all the people of war with him against them by the waters of Merom suddenly, and they fell on them. And Yahweh delivered them into the hand of Israel, who smote them, chased them unto great Zidon. Now, brothers and sisters, we start to find out why Barak and his men don't just fight Sisera, they chase Sisera out, because that's what Joshua had done. And they come in the valley of Mizpah, and they smote them until there was left none remaining. Just remember that expression. We're going to see that in our second study. And Joshua did unto them as Yahweh bade him, and he hoffed their horses and burnt their chariots with fire. And Joshua at that time turned back and took Hazor and smote the king thereof with the sword. For Hazor beforetime was the head of all those kingdoms, and they smote all the souls that were in with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying them. There was not left anything to breathe. And he burnt Hazor with fire. And all the cities of those kings, and all the kings of them, did Joshua take and smote them with the edge of the sword. And he utterly destroyed them, as Moses, the servant of Yahweh, had commanded. So here's the question, brothers and sisters. If Joshua had done that in Joshua chapter 11, what on earth is Jabin now living again in a resurrected castle only moments later in history? Here's a new king calling himself Jabin, living in a recently refurbished city that had been once taken by the children of Israel. What had they failed to do, brothers and sisters? And the answer was, because of Naphtali's faithlessness, Barak's tribe, brothers and sisters, they failed to capitalize on that conquest and lost it. And now they were paying for it. You see, because now another king had arisen and taken back the city of Hazor and had taken on the title of his predecessor from 110 years before that, and now had expanded his empire even further. And he didn't just now want the city of Hazor. He didn't just take back the city of Hazor. He was now not just the king of Hazor. Brothers and sisters, we come now to Joshua chapter 4, and he's the king of Canaan, brothers and sisters. He's taken all the territory. And boy, oh boy, is he going to make Israel pay for their crimes. Naphtali is now going to be oppressed. They're going to be his servants. And he mightily oppresses them, says Judges chapter 4. He mightily oppresses them. You see, lesson in that, brothers and sisters. If we don't take away, if we don't destroy the things that take away from God and that lead us out of the truth, if we don't utterly remove things like that, they're going to come back and bite us. And not just bite us, they're going to come back with so much more force because they are feeling oppressed. They're going to come back with double pressure. We can't just temporarily remove from view like a band-aid. We've got to utterly cut off things while we can so that we can take our inheritance. And so the oppression of Jabin's military campaigns were managed now by a man called Sisera, the captain of his host. His name means array, battle array. Sisera's name means a battle array. And by name, Sisera was also by character. You see, this man was a military genius, a military strategist, a warrior who marshaled army all over the Jezreel Valley. He led and he marshaled that an entire army from a city called Harosheth of the Gentiles. And you know what's remarkable about this city? The Hebrew word for Harosheth means a city of mechanical workers. Just tuck that away in your brain. We're going to come across that in our third study tomorrow. A city of mechanical workers. It means a root word for carving and cutting. It was a city of artificers and workmen, beaters of metal. These were the city of the grease monkeys and the panel beaters, right? They were apprentices. They had them up all over the place trying to take them from all around the surrounding tribes. It's Harosheth of the Gentiles. They had gone and handpicked the best people for this job. And under that oppression, it says, verse 3, the children of Israel cried unto Yahweh, for he had 900 chariots of iron, and 20 years he mightily oppressed the children of Israel. 900 chariots of iron. You see, these little metal objects, brothers and sisters, stood as a testimony, a witness for their faithlessness. Their nightmare had returned. Their faithlessness of their grandparents' failure and their parents now comes back in vengeance to haunt them. And for 20 years, it says, he mightily oppressed them. You know, the word mightily is only used two other times in the Old Testament, and it's a word that is used of entire dominant strength and force. And the word oppression is used only really to describe Israel's oppression from the Egyptian bondage and slavery. Mightily upon it. It was the worst oppression Israel had ever faced. It was worse than Egypt. It was worse than Eglon. And it lasted for 20 years. Brothers and sisters, that's what happens when we don't utterly remove things that cause us problems. How bad was it, brothers and sisters? How bad was that oppression? Well, it says, Judges chapter 5 and verse 6, it was so bad in the days of Shamgar, in the days of Anath, in the days of Jael, the highways were unoccupied and the travelers walked through byways. That's how bad that oppression was. Judges 5 verse 6. It was so bad that they were scared to travel between cities. And if they had to, they'd use the goat tracks from the back country just in case. It was worse than COVID. It was tough. And you know what? It says, when it says that the highways were unoccupied and the travellers walked through the byways and the inhabitants of the villages ceased. They ceased in Israel. It means to come to an end. The main arteries for food were closed. The main way of getting things around the country was gone. Anyone wanting getting around to travel had to travel through the gnarly goat tracks of the back country. No one moved around. Food was scarce. Trade was not existent. The noose of Sisera and Jabin grew tighter and tighter as the mighty oppression of sank Israel into complete and utter depression. And it's into this scene of utter misery and oppression and depression we're introduced to one that gave comfort. Deborah, it says, was a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth. She judged Israel at that time, and she dwelt under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in Mount Ephraim. Deborah, her name means a bee. And really, it's a reference to its systematic instincts and processes. I've had a bit to do with bees in my time. Happy to talk about them. Remarkable. The thing about a bee is they are really organized. So the idea of to be systematic in its instinct and its processes means that she was an ability to arrange things. That's what the root word means, to arrange. And it refers to, in this stomach, her voice. She was obviously capable of putting things together in a way that made sense. She could arrange words of counsel. Deborah was a bee, and one could refer to all her diligence as a worker as she was. But the record wants us to realise that although she was diligent, it was the order and arrangement of her counsel and advice that she was recognised for. She was a prophetess. You know, it's remarkable when you look, we don't have any time to look at it, Psalm 19, Psalm 119, the sweet counsel of wisdom is going to reward like honey. You ever look at those expressions? Honey is sweetness. Psalm 19, verse 9 and 10, and Psalm 119, verse 103. And this woman was able to provide food that was so delicious that the nation came day after day. Because in a spiritual wasteland, and in a vacuum of leadership, in the time of the judges, her refreshing counsel of her judgment would have come as relief to the people that sought counsel from her. She's the prophetess. Do you know, what is the work of a prophetess? Well, Deuteronomy 18 says that the work of a prophet was to expound God's mind and to expound God's message. She had been moved by Yahweh's words and had prophesied of their oppression and God's judgments at the hand of Jabin due to their idolatry. And this, therefore, brothers and sisters, I believe, earned her a reputation among them as speaking God's mind and God's message. And all Israel, it says, came to her for judgment. Do you know that's remarkable, brothers and sisters, because judges were supposed to be appointed in every city. In every city, there was supposed to be a judge, Deuteronomy 16. And yet here, all Israel were coming up the goat tracks to receive advice from this remarkable woman. Where were all the other judges, brothers and sisters and young people? Leadership had failed. The inhabitants, it says, Judges chapter 5 and verse 7 says, that the inhabitants of the villages ceased. The words really mean the leaders or the chief rulers disappeared. Leadership completely gone. The place where the judges should have been, there was war happening in them. Leadership was gone. It's better translates the idea of the inhabitants of the villages. It's the chieftains or the rulers were gone. Leadership was disappeared. As a result of failed leadership, idolatry had entered the land, and thus God punished them. And because of this mighty oppression, all Israel had to scurry and dart from bush to bush, down the byways and the goat tracks, to seek the counsel from this remarkable woman. And she dwells under the palm tree of Deborah. We don't have any time to look at it, but the palm tree is a symbol of righteousness. And she dwells between Ramah and Bethel, the high place and the house of God. They knew where she was. They knew what she stood for. And therefore she was capable of giving advice. The palm tree, the upright, righteous palm tree. And Deborah came at a time of immense leadership vacuum and stood up and took on the responsibility of serving her brothers and sisters. You know, that's a lesson for us out of this study, brothers and sisters, if we haven't already got a few lessons. You see, leadership is service, not a position. You see, when times are tough, when the way is difficult, when we see people under stress, trial and anguish, whose responsibility is it to provide the support and to serve? And the answer is it's every single, each one of us that needs to see the need and step up and serve. You see, not everyone is going to be leaders like Barak, who are going to lead from the front, charging off into battle and leading the way. Not everyone can do that, brothers and sisters. But everyone can show Deborah-like leadership, to care, to show love, to offer support, to offer counsel in times of trial and hardship, and particularly in those times, leadership is needed. Leadership is not a position. Leadership is seeing a need and serving. We've each got to step up and show that we care. We can't just wait and expect others. You know, here am I, send him, is not the spirit of the Bible, is it? We've got to step up and show care. We're not wait for others to stand up. We care and love for one another is a requirement and a commandment of our Lord, who demonstrated leadership by service to those he loved. We've got to do the same. True leadership is all about the inspiration of others by the power of positive example through service. True leadership is like that, isn't it, brothers and sisters? It's about the inspiration of others by the power of positive example through what we do. And we're going to see and witness in our next study just how Deborah was so brilliant at that and how she was able to carefully and thoughtfully and lovingly but sternly empowers Barak, the hesitant commander, to lead, and who then will inspire others to lead himself and to serve and overcome their oppressors.